Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our southwestern studios. Thank you for joining us today for a conversation about birding. The weather is turning away from winter, and we're starting to see our feathered friends come back to the area in various ways, and excited to talk about that today on the show. We've got three guests joining us today. First of all, Ed Hahn is with the National Eagle Center in Wabasha. Ed, thank you for joining us on Newsmakers.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Carla Bloom is with the International Owl Center in Houston, Minnesota. Carla, thank you for coming on to Newsmakers today.
Always happy to talk about owls and other birds.
And Barbara Dirksen is with us. She is a longtime member of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology. I think currently, among other hats, she's the youth education coordinator and has just done so much to raise awareness of birding in southwestern Wisconsin. Barbara, thank you for being part of our panel today.
You're welcome.
So I guess my first question is I don't know if spring has sprung yet. We might yet get a little bit of cold weather as we kind of come back and forth. But as we're starting to see more and more of these birds come back, Ed, I want to start with you because we're kind of, I guess, on the end of eagle viewing season here in La Crosse, but still some opportunities to see those majestic birds in the La Crosse area and a little bit farther north. Talk about why this time is such an important time of year for that and what they're all doing here in our area.
Yeah, sure. So one of the most popular questions we get from our visitors or folks that follow us on social media is, when is the best time to see bald eagles in our region? And, you know, without a doubt, the answer to that is when the weather is the worst in the heart of winter. And we usually kind of put that between, you know, December and March. Now, the caveat with that answer is always it's a lot dependent, I guess, on the weather. So if we get an early winter, you know, that could be further into the earlier parts of November, possibly even October. It just kind of depends. Same thing is true on the back end of winter. So with this year, with kind of the early thaw that we've had, we saw kind of an abrupt end to peak viewing season for eagles. The rivers opened up, that starts spreading them out again, and they even had thaw places north of us where a lot of the migrant eagles are coming to us in the wintertime. So it's very dependent on the weather, but you know, the long and the short of it is we get that huge increase in eagles in the wintertime because there's many spots along the Mississippi River where the water is open even during the coldest parts of the winter. And that allows those eagles to get their primary food source, which is fish. So that's why we see those huge congregations in places like Wabasha, La Crosse, places around Winona, and certainly a lot of great viewing locations, even in Iowa. So we're definitely past the peak this year. We're still telling people that if you go outside and you're doing some early spring birding and you wanna see eagles, you want to look really high in the sky because the eagles that are moving are those migrants that are heading back north to their nesting territories. But they are very, very high up in the sky, riding those currents, those air currents and winds back north. So definitely past the peak, but there's still some things to see out there.
So I was out last weekend driving between La Crosse and La Crescent and going over the bridges headed into Minnesota. I saw, there were well over a dozen of them over to the north. And what a sight it was. Some of them were flying and some of them were just perched in trees, and it was just amazing. But what causes them for what reason do they come to our area in the first place during those really cold winter months? And then what causes them to scoot out of town?
Yeah. So the reason they're coming to us is food. So unlike a lot of other songbirds that people are familiar with that are going to be, you know, rain, shine, cold, warm, you know, come winter, they're going to be heading south. Bald eagles, if they have access to food, they're going to stay put, which is why the eagles that, you know, live locally here in this region, they really aren't heading out when the winter hits. They're going to stay put. They're just going to go to those parts of the river where the water is still open and they can still get those fish. the eagles that are coming to us are coming to us from places up in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, up into Canada. And as you can imagine, you know, there, if you live on a reservoir, a river, a lake, as soon as winter hits, you're going to be cut off from your primary food source because that water is going to freeze over. And so they are moving south out of necessity for food. And they're only going to move as far south as they have to find that food. Then they're going to settle down for the winter. So for a lot of those birds, that is the region that we live in here, Wabasha, Winona, La Crosse. And again, it's going to be a little bit dependent on the type of winter we get and the weather that we have. But, you know, December through March, that's pretty good bet you're going to see pretty substantial bald eagle activity in our region.
That's Ed Hahn from the National Eagle Center in Wabasha. And I'm pleased also to be joined by Barbara Dirksen. Barbara is a member of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology and a longtime birding enthusiast and educator here in the area. Barbara, talk about what kind of birds we should be on the lookout for this time of year when we're out taking our walks and kind of shaking off the winter blues for the first time.
We're seeing some of the early migrants, birds like red-winged blackbirds and sandhill cranes, killdeer, and some of them are insect eaters and are earlier than some of the really, the birds that are super dependent on insects. They'll be coming later, like in May, when they can depend on high quantity of insects. The birds that are coming through now sort of have a little bit more relaxed requirements for their diet. They can subsist on fruits and other things than just huge numbers of insects. So we do see eagles in other places than just the river. In my area, I live in Richland County. I've been seeing roadkill deer, and then the eagles will come and work on those. And then also, like even up and down the river and in other miscellaneous places, there are eagle nests that are often very prominent in view. And especially now, before leaf out, look out for those because eagles will be on the nest. And then in terms of other migratory species, what's coming are phoebes, kinglets, little tiny birds that flick their wings and flitting from one leaf to the next or one branch to the next. They're very cute. Along with, you know, their normal resident birds. And then we're still seeing some of the birds that have migrated here for the winter, like the juncos and tree sparrows. They'll be moving out soon in the next few weeks. Winter wren is another species that comes this time of the year. They're smaller than a house wren. They have little tiny tail that sticks straight up, and they like really brushy, tangly areas. So if you've got a creek bottom with a bunch of brush down in there tangled up against the bank, just keep your eye open for that kind of thing. And then there are the woodcocks. Woodcocks are in the shorebird family, but these birds like it more in the out in not shorebird areas, just like hills and open areas. They nest in the edges of the woods. And they do this wonderful courtship ritual. It's a sky dance where the male, these birds, you should look these up. They're just kind of odd looking squat birds with a long beak, and the eyes are situated a little higher up on the head than other birds, and they just look very strange. But this allows them to see predators from up on high. So here's this little squat brown male that's sitting at dusk, after dusk, or it's getting dark, finds an open area, and it makes this noise, ee, ee. And it does this for some random number of times. I've tried counting, and I never get a regular number of peens, is what they call it. And then it takes off and flies up in a big circle in the sky and does this twittery flight. And then after a few circles, it comes kind of chirpy, chirpy, chirpy down, and it lands, and then it begins to do its peen. All of this is to attract the female. They're in courtship mode doing that. So it's fun to go out on a quiet evening and listen for woodcocks. pick just, I have to go to various places to find them. The Kickapoo Valley Reserve Visitor Center is a pretty reliable spot. It's just the right habitat near some woodland and an open area. If anybody's in that area, it's a good place to go and listen for woodcocks.
There we go. Sounds good. Sounds like a good advice from Barbara Dirksen there. Carla Bloom is with the International Owl Center in Houston, Minnesota. Carla, we're talking, speaking of owls, we heard from Ed earlier about eagles having a very particular time of the year when they're active and can be seen. Owls, I think what most people know about owls is that they're nocturnal. So is there an owl viewing opportunity, or do people do that, or is it more sit out in the woods and wait till you hear them?
Owls are best done by hearing, by listening. That being said, one of the prime owl viewing opportunities is going to northern Minnesota to Saxdin Bog in the winter, where you can find some of the owls that are visible during the day and are large and generally don't have as much fear of humans either. So people tend to go there to see great gray owls, northern hawk owls, sometimes boreal owls if they're lucky. So that's kind of like the Mecca. People actually come from around the world to go to Saxdin Bog to see owls, because seeing owls is really difficult. You don't just wake up in the morning generally and say, oh yes, I'm going to go out and see some owls. It's much more difficult when you get into owls. But learning their calls, each species sounds different. Once you learn their calls, you really get a handle on what's going on around you. And pretty much everywhere we live in this bluff country region, you're in some owl's territory, whether it be a screech owl, a barred owl, a great horned owl. In the winter, we have saw-whet owls. Snowy owls can come through. Sometimes short-eared owls will come through. We can get groupings of long-eared owls in the fall and winter. Seeing them is tricky, but then the trick is, when you can see owls, everybody wants to come and see the owls. And now with social media and the internet, they can actually get loved a little bit to their detriment, where there's huge crowds and not everybody is aware of the best owling etiquette and how to respectfully observe them. So then things start happening that shouldn't be happening. You have some cumulative impacts. So one of the things that's happening right now is great horned owls have nested and they have babies that are now visible. And that is the best way to see owls around here, is at a nest. Typically, best practice is you don't share locations of owl nests, but it's kind of a double-edged sword. You want people to be able to experience an owl in the wild, but you don't want to have crowds of people or people doing things that they shouldn't be doing around nests, like bringing dogs or flying drones, which has happened quite recently. So we do actually have a section on the International Owl Center website on how to respectfully observe owls. Teaching people to keep distances and leave dogs at home, leave drones at home, minimize your time with the bird, be respectful of other people. That's something that often gets forgotten also. It's not just respect the birds, respect the other people. But there's quite a few things. And it also teaches people how to interpret owl behavior, because everybody likes to have strict guidelines. You should be this far away from the nest, or you can never do this, or you have to do this. And it boils down to every owl is unique and every situation is unique. And the birds, if you learn to read their body language, they will tell you if they're stressed, if their plumage gets compressed, if they start fanning out into a defense display, if they're staring at you. Our website gives pictures to teach people how to learn, oh, this is what a relaxed owl looks like. This is what a stressed owl looks like. So we're trying to help people learned so they can have that wonderful experience of seeing an owl without stressing the birds.
Our conversation continues in just a moment. That's Carla Bloom of the International Owl Center, also speaking with Barbara Dirksen, a member of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology. Ed Hahn is with the National Eagle Center, and I'm pleased to have them all here. Carla brought up an interesting point about the drones, and that leads perfectly into a subject that I wanted to make sure that we talk about, which is how are advancing technology, good and bad, for, you know, birding, depending on and how you use it kind of affects all of this. And so that's what we're going to talk about right after this quick timeout. If you'd like to find out more about our program, you can look at our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. There you can stream past episodes. You can find some contact information. If you have an idea or a question for the show, you can leave us a note there. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Thank you very much for joining us today. Our guests today are talking about birds. We've got Ed Hahn from the National Eagle Center talking about eagles and other birds. We've got Carla Bloom from the International Owl Center talking about owls and other birds. And we've got Barbara Dirksen, a member, a longtime educator with the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology. Guess what she's here to talk about? Birds. You guessed it. And so I teased before the break, and I want to get this into this because it's so exciting. The advancements of technology that we've seen in the last decade or so are just really remarkable. And yet, with these new advances in technology, it brings in all kinds of ethical questions and quandaries about how we interact with all kinds of wildlife, and specific today's conversation, birds. Carla, before the break, you were talking about the etiquette of owl watching. Broaden that out a little bit, and let's talk about the issue of drones and birding, because you really, using a drone, you can get that point of view that everybody just is eager to see because they've never experienced it before. Or they can have the picture that none of their bird watching fellows have to share on social media and what have you. And it can be really tempting. So what's the detrimental side of bringing drones with us out into the woods?
Well, first off, some parks, it's not legal to use drones. So that's something to be aware of. It is not legal to use them everywhere. And most owls and birds of prey are going to perceive a drone as a threat in their territory. And they're going to pursue it. Now, depending on the size of your drone, it might just injure your drone. But if you have a larger drone or if you have stronger blades, you could actually injure the bird when they go after it. So if you go onto YouTube and you search owl and drone, you'll find videos of owls going after drones. And it's not, oh, I'm looking at prey. It's a couple of owls going insanely after a drone. So basically, it's very stressful for the birds, and it's very much harassing the birds to have a drone next to them. A lot of researchers in the raptor world have experimented with drones because it gives you such a unique view, you know, to find out, are there chicks in that nest? If you're doing census surveys, you don't have to climb that rickety tree. Or it's so much safer in some ways, but they're finding that some species will tolerate it, some species don't. Maybe they tolerate it on one continent, they don't tolerate it on another. But as the general public, as a general rule, they just please stay away from drones. It's very stressful to
leave it to the professionals, huh? Okay.
Yeah. The other technological advancement that brings up ethical concerns with owls is playback. Now everybody has a smartphone. It's easy to have a little speaker, and you go out and broadcast calls to have owls respond, right? And the owls are responding, you need to understand, because they perceive an intruder in their territory. They're not just hooting or calling back just for fun. It's an aggressive thing saying, hey, wait a minute. They know what their neighbors sound like. Bird has a unique voice, and they know who their neighbors are. So if they hear their neighbors, yeah, you just hoot back at your neighbors. But if you have a stranger show up, that elicits a very high response, and that's why the birds are calling back. Now, used judiciously and cautiously in an education setting to give people this experience, we do that, but on a very limited basis. We don't do it during breeding season. We only do it fall and winter when the owls are most naturally vocal. We don't do it when they have young in the spring or when they're raising them in the summer. That's also when they're less vocal. But people need to be aware that using playback is not something you should be doing repeatedly in the same area, which means if you're on public property, if you're in a state park or something like that, it's probably something you should avoid, because those are places where those birds are very likely to hit, people repeatedly do playback to those birds. If it's in your backyard and you're doing it once or twice here or there, fine, it's not a big deal. But in public places, and I think in national parks, it's actually illegal to do.
I was camping in a state park last fall, and in northern Wisconsin, and the vocal activity among the owls in that park at a certain time of the night was both beautiful and made it impossible to sleep. But I was curious as to what it was they were communicating to each other back and forth. Is that just chit chat, or like, do they know which owls they're communicating with specifically? Like, when I hear your voice, I know it's Carla. Do they know which owls they're communicating with like that?
Yes, they do absolutely know who they're communicating with. And sometimes the calls are literally, this is my territory. I'm just letting everybody know it's taken. But if you have a stranger come in, whoa, then those vocalizations can get really heated. And barred owls just have this reputation of being super vocal, and they get really worked up easy. So they get into, their normal hoot is this, oh, 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 you know, the who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. Then if they get really excited, they can get into the caterwauling, oh, 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 ah, 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 and people start like, what, are there monkeys in the woods or what? And then they can do this other call that has been described as an alarm call, but I've seen it in more context than just alarm. And it sounds like a woman being murdered in the woods. It's like a, and then usually you get two long hoots on the end. But then there's individual variations. I've heard recorded one that does, and that's how that bird does it every time. So barred owls just do these crazy things, and nobody totally understands all of their vocalizations. They, I'm confident, understand them. We humans just don't have it all sorted out yet.
That is amazing. So Barbara, when you're out in the woods and you were naming all kinds of little birds that are around this time of the year, and some more that are coming later in the spring and summer, when their dietary needs can be more easily met, what about this issue of technology? Carla brought up the negative side of drones, but I could imagine technology improvements making it a lot easier for people to be able to identify the birds that they're seeing out and about and to let other people know about it. Are there websites that are common for people to use for this, or different applications that people take with them on the go to be able to identify the birds that they're seeing?
Yes, there are. First of all, Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology is one of the best places to get all kinds of information about birds, their sounds, their habitats, just videos, all kinds of common birds and birds that are similar to them, so you can sort things out. So that's a very helpful place to go. Out in the field, there are apps that you can put on your smartphone that help you identify, or you can look up a bird to see if you're looking at, if you think you've got the right one. There's one called Merlin that helps you sort things out and perhaps identify it. I'm not sure if it's 100% accurate or not. I don't use it a whole lot, but a lot of people do. So I'm not sure how to recommend it, but I think it's good. And then there are other guides that that have pictures. There's a Sibley guide, there's Audubon, there's a bunch of them. Some of them are free, some of them are just a few dollars. So that's a helpful thing to have. And you can actually, if you're trying to identify by voice, the same thing would occur as Carla was talking about. You can disturb birds in their feeding or their nesting activities if you play their song too much. But sometimes I use it and I get it really quiet so that it's not very loud, so I can compare what I'm hearing with the song that's on my app. And so I'm helping myself figure out what's which one it is. So I'd urge caution there, just like you should. And on migration, some birds sing a lot and some don't. So they're hungry. They really need to feed. They don't need to be bothering with what you're playing. So it's just wise to be very cautious about using sound. And then there's also eBird, which is Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology project. It's an online collection of bird data. So you can keep your own lists online, and you can actually, I use it just to, you know, instead of always writing in my notebook, I can use it, turn it on, and it'll mark my starting area spot, and then go for a walk, and I can write down what I'm seeing, and then I turn it off, and it marks how much time I've spent, how far I went, and I can submit it to eBird. And if you do timing and counting, they can use that kind of information for science and studying bird migration, all kinds of things.
It's amazing. So, it's amazing. Yeah. So in terms of the sound that you were, how well do these animals hear? If someone were to try to mitigate the negative impacts of that kind of noise pollution and what have you, if they were to wear headphones or earbuds, would that be enough to reduce the problems, where they could still use their device to assist them in their bird watching, or is even that disruptive?
I think probably headphones or earbuds would probably do the trick. Birds could probably hear better, way better than you think. Be cautious. And yeah, earbuds should work, I think.
Okay. That's
Barb. What do you think? Anybody else?
Ed or Carla, do you have an idea about that?
I don't, I guess, specifically, no. I would think that, yeah, if you're wearing earbuds, I would think that would be, you know, more than adequate to muffle the sound, or at least keep it contained to yourself. But, you know, as far as eagles go, I mean, they certainly have a very loud call. But I don't know how disruptive the sound would be, because they're more of a visual animal. You know, they're known for their eyesight, and so they're really, and we see that with the ambassadors that we have at the National Eagle Center too. You know, they're really focused on what they can see. They will call if they see, you know, an intruder coming into their perceived territory. But along with that, they're also typically going to make a visual display. You know, they might flap a little bit or hop around just to try to create more of a visual cue for any other birds that they're trying to communicate with.
I don't know who would be the best person to answer this question other than Barbara. So maybe it'll just be the Barbara show for this question. But I'd be interested in advice from all three of you. I don't know what I'm doing. I know I see pigeons in my backyard, and I see, you know, I hear the owl that we talked about earlier, and I see cardinals hopping around from bush to bush. And other than that, not a whole lot. But when I go out and for a walk, or I go see some things, I hear all these kinds of bird sounds. I see them. I'm interested in learning more about this, but I just don't know what I'm doing. So where does a novice like myself need to start, who just doesn't have education or experience in this area? Barbara?
Well, start slow, be patient. People learn in different ways. Sometimes people really tune into the sounds. Other people, depends on, you know, how well you hear, or eyesight, or something else that maybe is indefinable. But people really key in on different things about birds, so they learn in different ways. So it just kind of depends on that. I really tuned in to bird songs when I was a kid, and that was my first real kind of passion about learning the songs. And so I didn't have any of the, you know, recordings or anything. I just had to watch them sing. I didn't even have binoculars when I started. My mother taught me the difference between a cardinal and an oriole song, and her mother taught her. And so that's how I got a start. And then the bird books we had were, you know, this little paper pamphlet from some little newspaper called the Capper's Weekly, that were these exquisite line drawings of Kansas birds. So I had a pretty primitive beginning, but now we have all these aids. The best way to really learn quickly is to find somebody who's leading a field trip. And that often occurs in spring during migration, and sometimes in summer. And, you know, the leader will usually know what the birds are and be able to point them out and try to be in an area where the birds will be more visible. So that's a really good way to learn.
Carlin, what got you involved in being interested in birds the first time?
I grew up on a farm, so I was just kind of around things. I didn't have guidance from my parents, so just kind of started paying attention and had some little field guides and took pictures, and then went to college for biology and then worked under an ornithologist. So that's where it really happened. So I was in college in the 90s. My training in birds was cassette tapes. This was before we had CDs. So I think we had about 30 different species of the common species of the area. And you just played it and 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 played it. And, you know, the first 30 you learn are the hardest to learn by ear, because it's like you're creating this framework in your head of a new type of way of learning. And then once you get, like for me, it was the first 30. Once those are fairly embedded in your brain, then when you get a new one, you can say, oh, well, it's kind of like this one. And then the next one is kind of like that one. And then it's easier to start stuffing more bird calls into your head and remembering them better. But if you pick kind of a core set of these are common species that I'm going to hear, and then you literally just play them and play them and play them and play them. And I still even do that with owl calls, because there's 200 and some species in the world, and I would like to know a whole lot of them. So on my phone, I've got a file of, you know, hundreds of owl calls, and not just their primary vocalizations, other ones. And sometimes in the car, we just play it and play it and play it. And sooner or later, more and more of them stick.
We're talking about birds today on Newsmakers, and our guests are Barbara Dirksen, a member of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, Carla Bloom of the International Owl Center in Houston, Minnesota, Ed Hahn, the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota, and we are interested in learning more about birds, and after the break, I'll ask where some fun places are that we can go to, and I'll ask Ed and Carla each about their centers and how the public can interact with them. And that's all coming up. Remember, if you'd like to learn more about Newsmakers, or maybe hear a previous episode or some part of this interview that you didn't get a chance to hear yet, you can find it all on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. Our show continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking about birding today with Ed Hahn, Carla Bloom, and Barbara Dirksen. And I want to make sure that we highlight a couple of the organizations that are represented here today, starting with the International Owl Center. Carla, talk about what the center does and what of your public-facing activities, kind of what people can be involved with at the moment.
Okay. So the International Owl Center is primarily about education, but we also have a secondary focus on research. So most of what people see us doing is the education component. So we are open to the public right now on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. And we have time slots that people need to pre-register for so that we can manage that we don't have more than 20 people in the building at one time, because we're like the Eagle Center. They started out in a storefront. We're in the storefront. They've moved into the big building. So our visitation is much more limited, but please do pre-register or call ahead. Make sure we have space for you to get there. And on our website, internationalowlcenter.org, you'll see what the time slots are and how many spaces are available. And definitely do that in advance, because we are selling out for most of our program spaces. Fall and winter, we do owl prowls once per month. As I mentioned before, we don't do those in spring and summer. People always ask, but we don't specifically, because the owls are raising young and they're much less vocal this time of year because they are raising the young and they don't want to draw attention to their families. One other thing that's of interest is we have a live streaming cam on Rusty and Iris. They are a retired pair of breeding great horned owls. We bred them for a vocal study on the species. And they were wild injured. They came from the Raptor Education Group in Antigo, Wisconsin. Both have eye issues, but they're totally wild. They're not habituated to humans, so we wanted them to behave as normally as possible. So what we did is we built a large facility with security cameras and live streamed that video feed online so that the people who were watching could help with observations. They could help note, oh, at this time, Rusty made this sound, or eggs were laid at this time. So it's kind of been a citizen science project. Rusty's eye, he only has one eye because of his injury and has extremely limited vision. And because of that, they're officially retired, so not allowed to raise young anymore. And don't tell Rusty, but the eggs have been not been fertile the last few years anyway. But the fun thing about watching it, even though they can't raise babies, they'll still go through the incubation and we let Iris sit till she abandons, which she's done now. And she's done with the hanky panky, even though Rusty tried very hard to get her to go again. But because the audio is really good, you can hear all the birds in the area. So if you watch the live video, and we have on the streams on YouTube, we have chat room moderators who are pretty good with what's going on. So morning and evening, the moderators are usually there and they can help you with the birds that you're hearing. So you will hear woodcock every morning and every night displaying right out in front of the aviaries. You'll hear whippoorwills later into the season. Once we get into late May and June, you'll hear whippoorwills there. You'll hear the sandhill cranes calling. I don't think the snipe come close enough to hear, but the moderators can sometimes help you with which bird species you're hearing. And then the frog species. We also, of course, hear the frogs too. So that live video feed is much more than just owl calls, but that was the intention of it to start with. So that's kind of how most people experience us, is either physically in person at our center or online there.
And the Owl Center's website one more time?
internationalowlcenter.org.
Wonderful. Ed Hahn is with the National Eagle Center in Wabasha. Ed, talk about what the Eagle Center is offering to the public at the moment.
Yeah, so it's a very similar situation to what Carla described with the Owl Center, in that we are obviously impacted pretty directly by COVID. We are also doing pre-registered visitor sessions Friday through Sunday at the center. And I would definitely tell people to go to the website ahead of time. That's nationaleaglecenter.org. And you can see what dates and times are available to sign up to come and visit. We're currently doing 90-minute visitor sessions that can have up to 80 people in the building at a time. And we have been selling out during our weekends here during March. So unfortunately, we've had to turn quite a few people away at the door, which is we always hate to do, especially with our audience being very accustomed to just, you know, pulling up, parking the car and walking in and spending as much time as they want in with the Eagles. But we just can't do that right now. So to kind of supplement the in-person experience, we will be doing quite a few pre-recorded programs that we will be sharing throughout the course of the next few months here as we go through spring. And so those will be free to view on YouTube as they come out. So we'll be letting people know when those are getting ready to drop so they can go in. And of course, those will be out there for people to watch, you know, as many times as they would like. So that's something we're excited about and we'll be doing here in the spring. I guess one other thing is, you know, as we come into April, we will be adding Thursday to that visitor schedule. So it'll be 90-minute visitor sessions at 10 a.m., noon, 2 p.m., Thursday through Sunday, with a 4 p.m. session on Saturdays as well.
Okay, and where can people find information? What's your website?
NationalEagleCenter.org.
All right, that's Ed Hahn. Barbara Dirksen is with us as well. Barbara, in terms of people just getting out, walking about, seeing birds, knowing where the good locations are, I guess you got to strike a balance between finding places that are accessible for people to get to if they're not familiar with the activity, but also not so overrun with people that there are no birds there.
Pick a park and go hiking.
Okay.
You'll find birds. Kickapoo Valley Reserve is a large area, so it shouldn't be overcrowded where you go. Places along the Mississippi River are excellent for spring migration. Birds follow the river, and sometimes you get huge numbers of warblers in May, and Goose Island is a nice spot for something like that. Also, some water birds. Shady Maple Overlook, south of Goose Island along the highway, is a pull-off area with parking parking areas that's really good right now for waterfowl. Those are birds that, you know, kind of stay in one place for a little bit so you can get a good look before they fly off. And in general, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology has a book called Wisconsin Bird Haunts. It's getting a little out of date, but the places are still good, and they show spots in southwestern Wisconsin. And they're embarking on a new project of putting that online as an interactive map. And so in a few months, that will be up. I'm involved in getting some of that site descriptions going for my area. There's the Sandhill Crane Count coming up, April 17, and the website is the International Crane Foundation sponsors it. So it's on our website, savingcranes.org. And you can contact the county coordinator if you're interested in helping with a count or going, well, you don't want to really, can't just go along with somebody these days, but next year. And that's a good time to not only observe cranes, but all kinds of other birds that are out there at dawn. This count takes place from 5:30 in the morning to 7:30, which is just the prime time for birds getting going and calling a lot and singing.
So in terms of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, you mentioned some of the resources that they're trying to make available online. Where is that a good place for people to start too, if they're looking for kind of an entree into how to get involved with birding in Wisconsin, specifically southwestern Wisconsin?
Yes, the website is wsobirds.org, and there's a lot of information there. It's statewide. They have an annual convention most years, except during pandemic times. And they also offer field trips all across the state. So that's a good resource.
I want to make sure we talk about an issue that we might not always think about, and that is how the things that we do to our yards in the springs, to our areas, can affect the wildlife around us. People are either out now or about to be out with various kinds of herbicides and pesticides. I have a storage unit that's about 200 yards in view of a wonderful eagle's nest in the La Crosse area, and yet I have mice in my storage unit, and so one family member was saying, get the poison, and I was like, no, get the not poison. So we were trying to talk about that. Let's talk about those kinds of toxic substances. What kind of harm is that creating when people use these chemicals in their lawns, on their properties, for birds and other wildlife? I don't know who wants to go first with that one. Carla, go ahead.
I would love to jump into that one, because this, at the conclusion of every program at the Owl Center, we talk about what our visitors can do to help make the world a better place for owls. Now, we frame it around owls, but it's good for a lot of other things also. Because most people are not aware of how their actions are impacting owls and other wildlife. So you mentioned a biggie, rodenticides. Rodenticides are formulated so that the mice and rats don't die for 4 or 5 days after they eat it. Because if they didn't eat a lethal dose and they just got sick, they'd never touch it again. So it's formulated, they're not going to die for several days. They eventually start bleeding internally. They get thirsty, so they go out in search of water, which means they leave your buildings, and they're easy prey for owls and other predators. So when the owl eats them, they're consuming the poison also. It poisons the owl. Now, if it's a small owl, it may die right away, like a screech owl. If it's a large owl, like a great horned, it may stay, that poison may stay in its body for, I just heard a study on barred owls, it can be up to 3 years before that poison is eliminated from their system. So a super easy thing that everybody can do is switch to using traps instead of poison. Now, whether you want to use live traps, snap traps, zap traps, they even have CO2 traps. There's like a million kinds of traps, homemade bucket traps, anything. Sticky traps, avoid. Those are non-discriminatory. They catch and kill other things. But almost any other kind of trap is fantastic. Another thing that's really important in spring is people are cutting down dead trees or pruning off dead branches off of their trees. This is when screech owls and other owls are nesting. So please do not do that until late summer or fall if you can wait, because every spring we get calls from people who were cutting down trees or pruning trees and they found a nest of baby owls, whether they killed them in the process or they're now orphaned or still alive or injured, whatever. Please wait to do those things until late summer or fall if they're necessary. But if you have a dead or a dying tree that's not going to hurt anything when it falls down, please leave it there. Those are wildlife hotels. They actually pay people in Germany and Austria to leave dead and dying trees standing because they're so important for wildlife. Other things people aren't aware of, even screech owls eat insects and worms. So if you're putting chemicals onto your lawn that's killing insects especially, this is not good for even owls and a heck of a lot of other birds. I personally think dandelions are pretty. I know I'm not in the majority.
Oh, I love them.
So we always encourage people to leave as much of their property natural as possible. People say, how can I attract owls to my property? Well, having a 5-acre mowed lawn is not how you attract owls to your property. A lawn is basically a biological desert. Things go through there, but they don't really live much in there. So if you're in the country and can leave parts of your lawn wild, fantastic. It's great for wildlife and other critters, which attracts the owls that eat those critters. If you're in town, you can't just say, oh, I'm not mowing my yard because it's good for owls and other wildlife. You know, they're going to, there's
the neighbors regulation. Might take exception.
Yeah. But if you can plant native plants, that's very helpful also. And a million other things like keeping cats indoors. Cats are an issue even for owls. So small owls like screech owls and saw-whets. I've dealt with both that have been caught and killed by cats. And certainly all the smaller birds are totally vulnerable to them. But on the flip side, then you have great horned owls. They're big enough to take a cat. Eagles, too, for that matter. It's not like it's a preferred dietary portion of their diet, but they can and do sometimes take them. So keeping cats inside is better for the cat and it's better for wildlife also. Now I can go on forever. We actually have a section on our website on how to live an owl friendly life, and we have about 19 different things. So I'll let Ed and Barbara have a chance at this too.
Ed, what about eagles? You talked about them fishing on the river, but are they affected by issues like pesticides, herbicides, those kinds of things?
Well, I think Carla hit it on the head. I mean, really, when you start getting into chemicals that, you know, once you start spraying something, where that chemical ends up is beyond your control. It's going to get into the groundwater. It's going to linger on residual, you know, whatever. If you're poisoning rodents, you know, then it's going to start working itself into the food chain, things like that. So while, you know, rodenticides may not be directly impacting eagles, it gets into the food chain and it's no good for anyone. The thing I was going to say is you look at the story of the bald eagle. You know, most of us know that it was critically endangered during the middle portions of the last century, and that was due to DDT. And DDT was insecticide that was heavily used, widely used, and it didn't seem like it had any harmful impacts on humans. And the problem with it was, is it didn't look like it really had any harmful effects on anything else. And, you know, just like the delay effects on those rodenticides with the rodents, the thing with DDT was it doesn't really kill an eagle outright, but it impacted their ability to reproduce and create future generations. And, you know, the thing that we really like to stress with people when they visit and learn about eagles is that right now the eagle is the poster animal for successful conservation. You know, that's a story where we came very close to losing our living national symbol forever. And we found the public policy, the public will, the buy-in to make the changes necessary to bring that animal back from the brink of extinction. And so that's the shining example that we need to look to and say, hey, we've done this before for bald eagles. We can make these kind of public policies and behavioral changes to benefit the rest of our wildlife. We don't need to endanger things or cause harm. We have ways to avoid that.
That's Ed Hahn of the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota. Ed, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Barbara Dirksen joins us from the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology. Barbara, thank you very much for joining our conversation.
Glad to be here.
And Carla Bloom is with the International Owl Center in Houston, Minnesota. Carla, thank you very much for participating today.
Thank you very much for having me. I love to talk about owls and other stuff.
Wonderful. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. The producers of this show are John Davis and Dawn Jewell, and I thank them very much along with the rest of our lacrosse staff. A couple of opportunities to hear the show each week at 10 a.m. on the Ideas Network, 90.3 in lacrosse is when our show originates, and we repeat at 7 p.m. on NPR News and Music, 88.9 in lacrosse. You can find us online all the time at WPR.org/newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Please join us again next week for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.